Welcome to the 13th message of our series, Live in Grace, which is part two of our study of the life of David. Keep watching as we look at the root of David's failure in his relationship with his son Absalom. Although he had great affection towards Absalom, David's failure to show his son tough love through discipline led to disaster. And every year it seems like there's a bunch of films that are, you know, the big blockbusters, and we talk about it, but there's only a few that are ones that really become classics, that become memorable. And the rare ones are the ones that at the time they're released don't seem to be that big, but then over time they become bigger. An example of that is the classic 1971 film, Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory. Actually, when it was first put out, it received generally positive reviews, but it didn't do that well in the box office. It actually made just a little bit more than it cost to make. It was based on the book Charlie and the Chocolate Factory. And what's interesting is that both the book and the movie were actually trying to make a statement beyond just being entertaining. They were making a statement about the direction that the author felt that the culture was going, especially about parenting and children in the midst of what they saw as this prosperity of the culture. In the book and the movie, the first four kids that find the golden ticket are all extreme in their desires. They're all rude and demanding and out of control. But the story shows that it's not just that they're bad kids. In all cases, all four of the kids, the parents consistently choose to give in to the demands of the children, indulging them and doing all that they, you know, that they demand them to do. They never stand up to their whining. And the story, the lesson is that there's a sense that these are bad kids because they're bad parents. Now, in contrast to these four kids, you have Charlie. And Charlie, who's raised in extreme poverty, but he has loving parents and loving grandparents, and they don't give him all the things that the culture demands, but they give him, out of simplicity, the things that were most valuable, character and strength, and the strong character that prepared him for the bigger blessings of life. Now, probably out of the four first kids, the most extreme is Veruca Salt. And she's the ultimate spoiled brat. She demands everything that she wants. She throws a tantrum until she gets it. And her parents always give in to the demands. And in the movie, we first meet Veruca when she's demanding that her dad find a golden ticket and that he do it now. And let's watch a scene and we'll see that introduction.
Angel, we're doing the best we can. I've got every girl on the bleeding staff hunting for you.
All right, where is it? Why haven't they found it?
Veruca, sweetheart, I'm not a magician. Give me time.
I want it now. What's the matter with those twerps down there?
For 5 days now, the entire flipping factory's been on the job. They haven't shelled a peanut in there since Monday. They've been shelling flaming chocolate bars from dawn to dusk.
Make them work nights.
Come along, you girls! Put a jerk in it, or you'll be out in your ears, every one of you! And listen to this! The first girl that finds a golden ticket gets a £1 bonus in her pay packet! What do you think of that?
They're not even trying! They don't want to find it! They're jealous of me!
Sweetheart, I can't push them no harder! 19,000 bars an hour they're shelling! 760,000 they've done so far!
You promised, Daddy! You promised I'd have it the very first day!
You're going to be very unpopular around here, Henry, if you don't deliver soon.
It breaks my heart, Henrietta. I hate to see her unhappy.
I won't talk to you ever again. You're a rotten, mean father. You never give me anything I want. And I won't go to school till I have it.
Veruca, sweetheart, angel. Now, there are only four tickets left in the whole world, and the whole ruddy world's hunting for them. What can I do?
For that.
Aye. Happiness is what counts for children. Happiness and harmony.
Now, here's the question I'm going to ask. I'm not going to ask if that's good parenting. Let me ask a more probing question. Is that loving parenting? Is giving our kids all that they want or demand, is that the loving thing to do? Or is it actually unloving? You know, I know Veruca is an extreme example, but unfortunately, it's extreme only in that the parents had everything to give. But it's not that far from what is common in today's culture of parents and their extreme permissiveness. But again, we've got to ask, is that loving? Is that kind of parenting, giving everything that is wanted, kind of, you know, giving into the demands, is that loving parenting? Now, to help us think that through, what I want to do is to start by looking at two different examples of fatherly love from the story of David. And there's a sharp contrast here. The first example, we're going to actually go back several chapters, back to chapter 12. And we're going to look specifically of God's love towards David, God's fatherly love, but it was a tough love for David. And it was the love that he showed immediately after David's sin with Bathsheba. Now, if you remember, if you know the story at all, if you remember with us in the study, after David's sin with Bathsheba, he had first tried to hide it. He tried to cover it up, and we couldn't hide it. He went to the extreme of ultimately killing her husband, Uriah, to hide the sin. And after Uriah was dead, he then married Bathsheba, and he thought he had gotten away with his sin. And the Bible tells us that he lived with this for the better part of the year, thinking he had gotten away with it. But he didn't, because God wasn't fooled. And in time, God sent his prophet, a man named Nathan, to confront David over his sin. And not only did Nathan expose David's sin, but he also pronounced some incredibly hard consequences that would result from that sin. Now, here's a question to ask. What motivated God to send his prophet Nathan? What motivated that whole confrontation? Was it God out of his anger? Was it God as the righteous judge who acted out of anger, who wanted to expose and then condemn David for the wrong things that he had done? Was it anger or was it love? Was it God acting as a loving father who, in an act of loving discipline, sought to expose David's sin with the purpose of ultimately healing his soul? Now, I will tell you, the moment that David was exposed and that Nathan spoke those words and then spoke the words of consequence, I'm sure it did not feel at all like love to David. I mean, that was what he wanted to avoid the most. And not only when he spoke the words of consequence, but when David felt the consequences coming through in his life and God didn't protect him from those consequences, that didn't feel like love either. But if we have any question as to God's motive, all we have to do is to look at David, where at first maybe he didn't say, "Boy, welcome that, thanks for coming." But look at what he says in the weeks and months after as he reflected upon this whole thing. He wrote two psalms after this confrontation. The first is in Psalm 32, and look what he writes. "Blessed is the one whose transgression is forgiven and whose sin is covered. Blessed is a man against whom the Lord counts no iniquity and in whom spirit there is no deceit." And he's basically saying the painful confrontation that God gave me led to forgiveness, and that's what I needed more than anything else. And I realized that made me blessed. In other words, God's painful discipline, the thing that I didn't want to hear, the thing that I didn't want to experience, that was a blessing. That was a good thing. In verse 3 and 4, he continues, what was happening through that time where he thought he had hidden things before it was confronted. Look what he says. "For when I kept silent, my bones wasted away through my groaning all day long. For day and night your hand was heavy upon me, and my strength was dried up as by the heat of the summer." So he's saying beforehand, I was being crushed by my guilt. I was being crushed by what was happening. It was destroying my life, but God blessed me by coming and bringing the messenger that I didn't want to hear because it was the act of a loving father. And so you look at that and you say, that's what it was like beforehand. Now let's go to Psalm 51 and see what he says reflecting. This is what changed. Psalm 51:8, he starts by, describing the result of the confrontation and his repentance, and he says, "This is what happened. Let me hear joy and gladness. Let the bones that you have broken rejoice. It restored my soul. It healed me." And then in verse 12, he described the end result of this painful process, revealing what was always God's motive. He continues, "Restore to me the joy of your salvation and uphold me with a willing spirit." And so what we look at is when we see this, it's obvious that David was thankful for the confrontation. And while he didn't welcome it at the moment, When he looked back and he saw the result, he saw that it was something that, while he didn't want it, it was something that was incredibly valuable. It's something that he desperately needed. He understood that it was the act not of an angry judge, but of a loving father. A painful disciplinary act, but it was a loving father who was committed to his health and his well-being and was willing to bring the pain of discipline in to accomplish that. Now, what's interesting is we look at that and we say, okay, David experienced that. He experienced the love of the Father. And what's amazing is the love that he himself experienced and valued, he was unwilling to show to his own son. Because that's the contrast we look at from, you know, God's love of David, and you contrast it with David's love for his son. But it wasn't a tough love, it was a passive compassion. See, in our study of David, we're picking it up in chapter 18, and here's where we're at in chapter 18. His son Absalom has rebelled against David. He's led a revolt against his father. He's driven him out of Jerusalem. He's raped some of his concubines. He's formed an army to go out and kill his father. And we have to ask, how did this happen? And it happened in large part, as the result of David's unwillingness to show the same kind of tough love towards his son that God had showed towards him. See, David was unwilling to confront the sin of his children. He was unwilling to bring any kind of discipline. And let me kind of sum up, you know, what we've seen in our previous weeks. You go back to chapter 13 of 2 Samuel. And what we saw is that in chapter 13, David's oldest son, a guy named Amnon, had raped his half-sister, a woman named Tamar. And in verse 21, we're told that David heard about it. He was furious, but he didn't do anything about it. It was something, it's like, how do you confront that? How do you deal with that? So he just let it go. And then at the end of chapter 13, Absalom finally takes it upon himself and he takes his revenge by killing the half, you know, to Amnon. But again, David hears about it, but he doesn't really do anything. Absalom runs away and David doesn't do anything. And so then in chapter 14, we read that Absalom eventually was brought back by David, back to Jerusalem. You know, it seems like there is a restored relationship, but what's clear is that the sin is never addressed. It's never confronted. There's never a Nathan moment where it says, this is what you have done, and here are consequences. Instead, it's forgive and forget. It's bury and ignore. It's let's just pretend it didn't happen, and let's go on through life. But what happens is what we realize is that in protecting him from the pain of confrontation and accountability, he also kept him from the healing of forgiveness. And then in chapter 15, we read that Absalom is out in front of the capital every day, going out and criticizing his dad and basically telling people, you know, if I were king, I would be a whole lot better. And David knows this is happening. David knows that his son is not only undermining his rule, but in a sense setting the groundwork for a rebellion. And again, for 3 years, David does nothing. And we have to ask, why didn't he do anything? Why did he never intervene? Why didn't he speak the truth? Yeah, we know that David was a man of powerful emotions. And when we read this whole story, we read that there was an incredible affection for his kids. But you know what happened is that you see in this affection that sometimes this affection is, I don't want to cause them pain, because when I love my kids, if I cause them pain, then it's painful for me. And I don't know how to do this. I don't know how to deal with this. And he didn't want to cause them pain. He didn't want to cause a rift in the relationship. And so, and in a sense, to protect what he valued, he never took the risk of confrontation and accountability. He never confronted them. But in all his attempts to seemingly protect his children, he also ultimately caused them the ultimate harm. Because what happened is in his desire to safeguard Absalom from the effects of what he had done, ultimately he led him down a path of anger and rebellion to the point where he now tries to overthrow his dad, he tries to kill him, and ultimately Absalom ends up dead. Now, to any of us who are parents or grandparents, there's an obvious application to this. As parents, it is vital for us to discipline our children. And we have to realize that it may not feel like the loving thing to do at that very moment. And we may be, even in the short run, be risking a short-term rift, a break in that relationship, especially as the kids get older. But what we have to realize is we have to be willing to risk that, because that kind of accountability is the only thing that will protect the long-term relationship. And this is true regardless of the age of our children. It starts when they're young, and it doesn't change when they get older. But it starts even when they're young. I remember back when my kids were in preschool, and I can think back at those times that they would, you know, come up and they demand attention, and they're, you know, they're demanding this, or they demand, you know, that I play with them or I hold them or whatever. And if I tell them no, oftentimes they become more demanding and more insistent and creating a fuss. And basically, Ruka's, I want what I want and I want it now. Now, the first thing for me to do, the right thing, is to warn them. You know, I said, no, if you throw a fit or whine, here's the consequence. But the easy thing to do is to give in. The easy thing for me to do it at the, you know, for any of these times, if I give in, what happens? It stops the whining. I don't have to deal with the whining anymore. And if I actually go through the discipline, if I put them in time out, you know, what's going to happen is that's going to take more time. It's going to likely lead to a battle. It's going to be unpleasant for not only them, it's going to be unpleasant for me. And I would rather give in to the demands. If I give in to the demands, well, I want to make them happy. I want to be loving, so I make them happy. But it makes me happy as well. See, what we have to realize is, what is it driven by? Often when we give in, it's driven in large part not by a love, but out of a selfishness. I want to do this because it makes my life easier. It's a whole lot easier to give in than it is to fight the battle of discipline. But if I give in to the demanding spirit, what I'm teaching them is basically, here's how to manipulate your dad. Here's how to become a Veruca soul, which I don't want to teach them. That's not what's in their best interest. That's not making them they're healthy. The fact is, we all want to be good and loving parents. We want to be good and loving spouses. But what does that look like? See, if we want to understand what it means to show the proper kind of love, what we have to do is go look at the example of God. How does he love us? What can we learn about the true nature of love as revealed by God's love for us? You see, our culture portrays love as being, if you want to be loving, you've got to be totally unconditionally accepting and affirming of the other person and all their decisions, all their lifestyle choices. And we often expect now God to act in that way. And you see this even being taught in many churches. You see many churches, it's interesting. There are churches that have signs out front talking about God is love, and God, you know, they advertise God's love. And what they mean by that is that God's love is he accepts everyone. You're not going to hear a hard word here. You're not going to hear any confrontation. You're just going to hear God's affirmation. But when you look at the Bible, when you look at the story even here of David, is that what God's love looked like? It's a problem, yes, in our culture, but it's not new. C.S. Lewis, some 70 years ago, commented on this as he saw it in his culture. He wrote in his book, The Problem of Pain, he talked about what people think of God's love. He said this, "We want, in fact, not so much a father in heaven as a grandfather in heaven, a senile benevolence who, as they say, likes to see young people enjoying themselves, and whose plan for the universe was simply that it might be truly said at the end of the day, a good time was had by all." And we look at that and you say, that's what people believe. But as we've seen in David's story and as we've seen in the rest of the Bible, that's not the kind of God love that God shows. It's really not even love. The Bible teaches that God's love, in fact, not only God's love, but all love that follows God's example, all true love will value the long-term health and holiness of a person over the short-term happiness. Now, this is something that is taught not only here, but it's taught throughout the Bible. One of the great passages where this is clearly taught is in Hebrews chapter 12. And in Hebrews 12, it talks about the fact that God, because he values our health and our holiness more than our happiness, is a God that will bring his children, those who are true believers in him, through discipline. Look what it says, Hebrews 12, starting in verse 6. "For the Lord disciplines the one whom he loves and chastises every son whom he receives. It is for discipline that you've had to endure. God is treating you as sons. What son is there whom his father does not discipline? If you are left without discipline, in which we've all participated, then you're illegitimate children and not sons. Beside this, we've all had earthly fathers who disciplined us and we respected them. Shall we not much more be subject to the Father of spirits and live? For they disciplined us for a short time as it seemed best to them, but he disciplines us for our good, that we might share in his holiness." See, what is his purpose? It's not that, okay, he's giving you everything to make you happy. His goal is, no, he wants you to be holy. He wants you to be healthy. "For at the moment, all discipline seems painful rather than pleasant." It's not about short-term happiness. At the moment, he will allow there to be painful in the short term. But it's short term. But later, it yields peaceful fruit of righteousness to those who have been trained by it. Now, I want to tell you, as I think about the times that I've, as a parent, that I've had to discipline my children, you know, it didn't feel like love to them at the moment, especially to them. You know, but what I've got to realize is that it didn't feel like that. It was driven by their best interests, by their health, by their holiness, even if it was at the short-term expense of their happiness. And they didn't always understand my motives. And what we have to realize, likewise, in our relationship with God, there are many times that God will allow us to go through a difficult time and we may feel he's abandoned us and we're looking for his love and compassion. We want that sense of, God, where are you? God, you're supposed to make me happy. See, again, does God value our happiness? Yes, but he values our holiness. He values our health, spiritual health, far more. And we may not always understand his motive, but we've got to understand that the motive is saying, I will bring you through difficult times to teach you to be holy and to be healthy spiritually. Again, look at what it says there in verse 11. At the moment, all discipline seems painful rather than pleasant, but later it yields peaceful fruit of righteousness to those who have been trained by it. Now, here's what I want you to realize is that there's another meaning to this that we sometimes miss. And that is when it seems painful rather than pleasant, that's not only for the person receiving the discipline, that's also for the person giving the discipline. It implies that it is not only painful for the child receiving the discipline, but it's also painful and difficult for the parent that's giving the discipline. And what it shows us, something is this, to give tough love, to show that great tough love, we have to understand and accept the nature of that tough love. There's something that we sometimes miss. And when we don't understand this, when we don't understand the difficulty of it, you know, then we avoid it because we don't understand why it's so hard. See, tough love is always painful, again, not only for the one receiving, but also for the one giving. And the fact is, the reason for it is this. For any of us who are parents or grandparents, the fact is that our heart is tied and connected to the heart of our kids. And so, in other words, when they are happy, we're happy. So when they're enjoying something, you know, we plan a surprise and we see them enjoy that surprise and we enjoy it. And meanwhile, on the other hand, when we discipline them or take away a privilege and we see them in misery, it makes us miserable. And this isn't only true of parenting, it's true of all relationships. Especially when we think about the relationship with our spouse, these principles are also true there. So we've got to understand how our heart is tied to the heart of the one we love. And that's why it's so difficult for a parent to discipline his or her child. Because the reality is the discipline hurts us. That's why it's difficult for us to show this tough love to anyone who we're close to. Why it's hard for us to show tough love to our spouse. See, when we think about discipline for our children, it means withholding some kind of blessing or giving some kind of painful consequence. And when we understand our hearts are bound to the hearts of our kids, we realize that it indeed does cause us as much or even more pain than it causes them. Now, as a child, we can't understand that. You know, I remember, you know, this is a line that some of us who are older might remember, and I don't think it's used as much anymore. But I remember with my dad, at times he would discipline me, and he would tell me, you know, he's preparing to spank me, and he says, I want you to know this is going to hurt me more than it's going to hurt you. And I didn't understand it, and I didn't believe him. You know, I really wanted to say to him, well, if that's the case, how about if we change places, you know? It's just, you know, I wanted to say that, but I lacked the courage because I didn't think that would help me get out of the problem that I was in. But that being said, why is it that we don't discipline? For those of us who are parents, for those of us grandchildren or grandparents, the primary reason is out of selfishness. It's primarily out of selfishness. We think it's out of love. We think that we don't want them to cause them pain, that we want to give them the things that are going to make them happy. But the reality is that it's usually driven out of selfishness. The fact that when I discipline, it hurts me, it's hard for me, and I don't want to go through the pain. And so I'm looking at it, and I value the short-term happiness because it makes me happy, and I'm willing to sacrifice the long-term spiritual growth and health to be able to maintain the short-term happiness. See, again, this is true not only of parenting, but it's also true of any close relationship. The fact is, close relationships, especially marriage, part of what marriage is it means that we are involved in this relationship where we need to speak truth to each other, that we need to be involved in each other's lives, and that we have a responsibility to challenge each other over sin. And I'm not talking about the little matters, on the big things. You know, and you see people that, you know, that give in to abuse, that give in to, you know, all kinds of sinful behavior, that have things that are just unhealthy. And why is it that so many spouses put up with consistent disrespect, with abuse, with harmful or sinful behavior? We may think it's out of love, but really it's usually out of selfishness. Because it's too hard, it's too painful for us to confront. Let me even try to show you some of where this is taught in Scripture. When we think about what God's command, let me speak more specifically to what God says to husbands. You know, when God says speaks to husbands in Ephesians 5 about husbands, love your wives as Christ loved the church. He gave himself up for. And a lot of times we can say, well, I give up. And that means I let myself get beat up. I let myself get taken advantage of. And I've sacrificed myself for my wife. Now, look what it says. It doesn't call us to do that to make them happy. Look what it says, Ephesians 5. Husbands, love your wives as Christ loved the church and gave himself up for her, that he might sanctify her, having cleansed her by the washing of water with the word, that he might present the church to himself in splendor without spot or wrinkle or any such thing, that she might be holy and without blemish. What it's saying is that I have a responsibility. Men, we have the responsibility to love our wives in such a way that it's not about saying, okay, how can I give you everything to make you happy? It's how do I engage in your life in such a way to help make you holy? I'm called to make you holy and present you to Christ as one who is holy. And that means that sometimes calling out hard words, you know, speaking tough truths, risking confrontation. And this is not just to husbands and wives, it's wives to husbands as well. That we're called to be helpmates, to help each other become the men and women whom God has called us to be. But it means showing tough love. But in reality, we think that we compromise and we think it's out of love, but in reality, our failure is rooted in selfishness that's masked by compassion. That when we look at it, we say, well, here's what I want to do. I want to avoid the difficulty. I don't want to feel the pain with you. And because I have that selfishness of avoiding that, therefore, I mask it with compassion. Well, I'm doing it out of love. So when we think about even David and Absalom. If David would have confronted the issues earlier, it would have been a whole lot easier. But even in that story, it illustrates a basic point. The reason we don't show tough love in our closest relationships, it isn't out of love for the other person, it's out of the selfishness of not wanting to go through the pain of discipline with them. So again, I think about discipline. Why do I avoid it? Because I don't want to put the work and effort into discipline. It takes time, it takes effort. And because my heart is tied to those I love, my child's pain hurts me. I want to avoid that. But again, Hebrews 12 teaches us that's not the way that God loves us. If God is the example of the way that I'm to love my children and the way that I'm to love my spouse, then I want to learn to love that way. And what do we learn from God's love for us? Just a basic principle here. If we follow the example of God's love for us, true love is a tough love that always values long-term health over and holiness over short-term happiness. And so that's when we think about parenting. And as a child, I value long-term health and happiness, and I'm willing to go into them with them and to embrace the hard work and the short-term pain that comes with consequences of teaching my children how to do what's right. Or with a spouse, you know, that we look at that and you say, I'm willing to risk. The fact is, I want to avoid fights. It's hard to do that, but I'm willing to risk that to speak truth when it needs to be spoken. Because I value the long-term holiness over the short-term happiness. And a lot of times we're afraid to do that because it's a risk. And what happens if they reject me? What if it happens if they walk away from the relationship? But you know what we're doing there? Is that we're saying I value the relationship, which is important to me, over the health of the person. So if I really love the person, if I love their health, I'm going to be willing to even risk that they may walk away from the relationship for a period of time because I'm more concerned about them being healthy and holy before God. Now, let's see some of how this plays out a little bit very quickly in this part of David's life. And what we're going to see in chapter 18 is there's a corrosive power of sin and there's a tough love of justice. If we go back to chapter 18, David's sending his army out to fight Absalom. And as they go out, He calls aside his three generals. If you look at 18, verse 5, look what it says. The king ordered Joab and Abishai and Ittai, deal gently for my sake with the young man Absalom. And all the people heard when the king gave orders to the commanders about Absalom. Now, even here, you have David, even at this point, concerned about saying, okay, we got to fight this battle, but I want to make sure I protect Absalom from the consequences of his behavior. And so what happens is they go out and they fight this battle, they fight this, it's a huge battle, and the side of David wins overwhelmingly. And pick it up in verse 9, and Absalom happened to meet the servants of David, and Absalom was riding on his mule, and the mule went under the thick branches of a great oak, and his head caught fast in the oak. And he was suspended between heaven and earth, and the mule that was caught under him went on. And a certain man saw it and told Joab, the general, behold, I saw Absalom hanging in an oak. And Joab said to the man who told him, what, you saw him? Why did you not strike him there to the ground? I would have been glad to give you 10 pieces of silver and a belt. Now I read that, and I'm like, okay, I understand the 10 silver pieces of silver. How about the belt? I mean, I'm not sure is it like a WWF champion belt or something? I'm not sure what that is. Continue on, verse 12. But the man said to Joab, even if I felt in my hand the weight of 1,000 pieces of silver, I would not reach out my hand against the king's son. For in our hearing, the king commanded you and Abishai and Ittai, for my sake, protect the young man Absalom. On the other hand, if I had dealt treacherously against his life, and there's nothing hidden from the king, then you yourself would have stood aloof. And Joab said, I will not waste time with you like this. And he took 3 javelins in his hand, and he thrust them into the heart of Absalom while he was still alive in the oak. Now, here's what I want to ask you. How do you feel about Joab's actions there? David asked him to keep him safe. Why did he kill him? See, what happened is when you look at this, David was so tender, but he was unwilling to make hard decisions. And what we see here is a hard decision that's, what's the right thing? Here you have a civil war going on, and we're told in this day 20,000 people are killed. And it's all because of one person. When Absalom's dead, the civil war ends. As long as Absalom's alive, the civil war continues. And thousands of people are being killed by the hour. And instead of insisting that Absalom be protected, David was now putting his whole army, putting the whole nation at risk because he's unwilling to make a hard decision. He's unwilling to say there are consequences to what Absalom has done. And what Joab realized is that, okay, there's not only an accountability here to Absalom, it's what's good for the nation. And Joab says, okay, I'm going to be willing to make the hard decision, what's good for the nation. And Joab knew that keeping Absalom alive would bring a personal reward. David would reward him and affirm him. But, keeping him alive would keep the whole revolt alive and would cost thousands of life. And what he's willing to do is he's saying, it's not about my interest right now, it's about what's right. Now, when we look at this, you say, most of us don't have to make this decision. But you know what? It says something, even a very nature about God. We've got to look at it, and we've got to say that there's a corrosive power of sin, but there's a tough love. There's something in a sense of justice. Because when we think about that, we think, oh, God is all loving, but God is also just. And the nature of sin is it's destructive. It's destructive in our lives, and it's destructive to the culture. And again, we expect, like C.S. Lewis, to be the godfatherly parent that just accepts everyone and will overlook sin. It's not too bad. And people are like, how could God send anyone to hell? But what we've seen is that while David is all loving and all compassion, that isn't loving towards Absalom. It isn't loving towards his people. And his long-term tenderness towards Absalom was the most destructive thing that he could have done, again, for the person and for the whole country. And if God were to have this attitude towards us and say, well, we're going to look at sin, well, I just want to accept it. What he's doing is he's saying the thing that would destroy you and the thing that would destroy those around you, I'm just going to accept it. And there's times that justice says that there's a holy God and he sees that which is destructive and he's going to oppose it, he's going to confront it, and if we're not willing to surrender, then ultimately he's going to judge it. And that's the nature of a loving God. But it's something that deserves to be judged. But because God is loving and gracious, he's made a way so that our sins that deserve to be punished and judged can now be forgiven through Jesus Christ. That's why Jesus died on the cross. That's why it was essential that he paid the penalty of death, the pain, because they were sins that deserved to be judged, and a just God couldn't just forget about it. He says, okay, I've got to deal with it. And if you're willing to surrender to Jesus Christ, God will forgive our sins because they're paid for in Jesus. And if we're not willing to, we've got to realize that our sins are not a small issue. God is not this grandfather. We can just forget about things. Because the fact is, you cannot do that. It's not healthy for us or for the culture. Now go back to 2 Samuel chapter 18 and 19, and we see that not only that, you know, that there's a need for justice, and if we don't, there's a corrosive power of sin. But true love will speak the truth that we need. Let's go back to chapter 18. David is told by this messenger that his armies have won. And what we're told is that, you know, that first, you know, they don't know about, you know, the son. And he says, okay, what happened to my son? And finally, you know, somebody comes to him and he says, your son was killed. And verse 33, the king was deeply moved and went up to the chamber over the gate and wept. And he said, oh, my son Absalom, my son Absalom, would I have died instead of you? Oh, Absalom, my son, my son. That was verse 19:1. It was told Joab, behold, the king is weeping and mourning for Absalom. So the king, the victor on that day was turned into mourning. For all the people heard that day, the king is grieving for his son. And the people stole in the city on that day as people steal, as those who are ashamed when they flee in battle. The king covered his face, and the king cried with awed voice, oh, my son Absalom, my son Absalom. Now here's what's happening. His focus has been his son. His reports come back, said he's killed, and he's publicly weeping. And as the army comes in, what happens, they've been risking their lives. You know, they've won this great victory. They've risked their lives for David and the kingdom. And instead of a great victory celebration, they hear the city's in mourning because he's mourning the loss of the son that led the rebellion. And so instead of a city that was celebrating with pride, they were all defeated and guilty, as like they had done something wrong. And here's what you have to ask. Okay, what would a loving friend do with David? See, compassion says, oh, David, let's talk and pray with you, and cry with you, and oh, this is so hard. And that's compassion, passive compassion. But tough love is going to say what needs to be said. Look at what happens. That's what Joab, in this case, is a friend who speaks tough love. Verse 5, then Joab came into the house of the king and said, you today have covered with shame the faces of all your servants who have this day saved your life and the lives of your sons and daughters and the lives of your wives and concubines. Because you love those who hate you and hate those who love you, you've made it clear today that the commanders and the servants are nothing to you. For today I know that if Absalom were alive and all of us were dead, then you would be pleased. Now therefore arise and go out and speak kindly to your servants, for I swear by the Lord that if you do not go, not a man will stay with you this night, and you will be worse off for all the evil that has come to you from your youth until now. And the king arose and took a seat in the gate, and all the people were told, behold, the king is sitting in the gate, and the people came before the king. Now here you have a friend who is willing to speak the hard truth. It's not the passive compassion. It's the tough love that's willing to say what he didn't want to hear. You know, David, if you're doing this, you know, everybody's going to run away from you. Everybody's feeling like this was a victory. Everybody feels like you don't care about them, that, you know, that you would rather us all be dead and Absalom be alive. I know that you're sad about your son, but you still have a kingdom to run. And your mourning is everyone, making everyone else feel guilty for risking their lives to win this great victory for you. And what we've got to realize, yeah, we go through time, and times of crisis, we're going to feel incredible pain. And we can become so fixated on our pain, but we forget that there's a bigger picture. And at times, we need people that are willing to say, no, you know, snap out of it. You got to live. You got to be a parent. You got to continue on with life. You've got to do what's right. Are there times that we're so caught up in what we are that we need somebody that is willing to speak the truth to ourselves? Because what you see here is, again, that Joab valued his friend's holiness and health over his happiness. And he was willing to speak the truth that he needed to hear, even risking the rejection of the relationship, kind of stepping over that short-term pain and saying, what you need to hear is truth that's going to help lead you to holiness and to health. Now, I'm just going to ask a couple questions in closing with this, as we think about this and apply it to our lives. So let me ask you two questions. The first one is this. If God is convicting you of your sin in your life, how are you responding to the tough love of his discipline? Because I know that there might be some here, and you know that there's something in your life. You don't have a relationship with God. Maybe, you know, you've been running away from him forever, and he's just leaning on you in ways that are tough. Or maybe you have that relationship, and you've been running away from him, and you can relate the sense of you're running, but man, there's a brokenness. And I want you to realize that God is pursuing you not as a judge that wants to expose and condemn you, but he's exposing you as a father who wants to heal you. And how are you responding to his tough love? The second one is this, as we think about applying God's love towards our relationships. Are your closest relationships characterized by the selfish compassion of David or by God's tough love? Are you willing to speak uncomfortable truth and follow through with painful consequences for sinful actions when necessary? And that starts with those of us who are parents, but it's also true of other close relationships, especially our marriage. And I want to recognize that I might be opening a door here for some people that's a really tough door, and you say, where do I go from here? And for some, I'd encourage you, you might need to go talk to a counselor, help you figure out what it means to start to put in that tough love when you haven't been doing it for so long. Let me even give you a couple books that might help you with this. A great book that was Boundaries. You know, it deals with this whole issue of saying, how do we set boundaries? How do we have this tough love that speaks truth and that, you know, that doesn't just give in? And it's a book that has not only done so well, but they've written all kinds of other, you know, boundaries with teens and with kids and boundaries in marriage. And a great one for marriage, an old book, but it's great, that deals with this whole issue of saying, how do we do this in the context of marriage? Tough Love, or Love Must Be Tough by James Dobson. Great book. But let me encourage you, you know, if you're there and you realize, boy, you've got relationships that you're compassionate towards the person, but you know it's not healthy. Let me encourage you to look at the love that God has shown you and realize that we're to follow the example of God's love for us in the love that we show others, that we value their health, their holiness, even over their happiness. And may God give us wisdom to know what it means to live that out practically on a day-to-day basis in these closest of relationships. Thanks for watching. If you have any questions about what we talked about, Jesus Christ, or church, feel free to reach out to us on Facebook, Instagram, or by email. The links are in the description.